With the rise of China, the Australian economy has gone through a continual process of realignment towards the world's next superpower. The climax was President Xi's visit to Australia this year, his address to the Parliament, and the commitment to a free trade agreement. Sometimes lost in the talk of what's in it for us is the question, what's in it for China? Well, 1,000 Chinese business leaders resident in China have been surveyed. And interestingly, given the relative David and Goliath size of our economies, three quarters of Chinese business leaders surveyed said Australia was important to China. The Australia-China Relations Institute at the UTS commissioned the survey. Its director is the former Foreign Minister of Australia, Bob Carr. Bob Carr, welcome to Breakfast.
Thank you, Fran.
Before we come to our relations with China, the sad news that Singapore's founding farmer Lee Kuan Yew has died. He was many things, of course, statesman, autocrat, very high profile, pretty sure. How will you remember Lee Kuan Yew?
I was honoured to be able to speak at a welcome to him when he came to Australia in 1988 for our bicentennial. I was state opposition leader, and I decided to say that Lee Kuan Yew's significance was that he showed a different model for economic development when overwhelmingly opinion was attracted to a London School of Economics, government ownership of the means of production, government planning from the commanding heights model. And he showed it could be done differently, and he provided what is today a trajectory for the other nine nations of Southeast Asia. He had a huge influence. One measure of his influence was that he provided a different model for Deng Xiaoping when in 1979 the emerging leader of China was looking for a way forward out of the impoverishment of the Cultural Revolution.
So the importance of this man in our region. Australia's focus is really shifting now and getting more and more entrenched in our region, obviously. You've commissioned this survey from the Australia-China Relations Institute. You've commissioned this survey of Chinese business leaders trying to get a sense of, you know, what they think about Australia and when they are making their investment decisions, where their relativities are in terms of this. Is Australia a better destination for investment than the US, Canada, Singapore or South Korea? And the clear answer is yes, it is. Is that as remarkable as it sounds?
Yes, I think it is. We've got very different values from the Chinese. Their media interpretation of the world, of course, has got a particular orientation. There's a lot of clutter before you get to any coverage of Australia in Chinese media. This is quite striking. I would not have expected Australia to have ranked top on a list that includes Canada, Germany. Germany is very popular in China, the United States, and New Zealand. But very clearly, 74% say we're attractive, and then it falls away to 37% for Russia, but we beat Singapore, Canada, New Zealand, Germany, the US.
Given that clutter that you talk about there, that, you know, matters concerning Australia wouldn't be cutting through, you wouldn't think very often, why do you think that is the case? Or is it simply the case that there's generally a benign feeling towards Australia? Is there any sign in this survey that will affect investment decisions?
I think the overridingly positive approach to Australia can be explained by, first of all, the success of President Xi's visit last November. And I think that would have sent a message that if Australia is worthy of a free trade agreement and what the Chinese and we have agreed to call a comprehensive strategic partnership, then there must be something going for us. We must be a friend of China. Certainly the Chinese president was enthusiastic about going to Tasmania, so he could say that he's now been to every one of Australia's six states. I think there's important symbolism in that, and that conveyed itself to Chinese opinion. I think both sides of Australian politics have worked very hard on the relationship, and after 3 months where the Abbott government seemed to be veering towards a hard line on China, pragmatism asserted itself and they worked hard and obviously effectively on the China relationship on the basis of what previous governments, Coalition and Labor, have done on this front. And I think beyond and behind these immediate factors is probably a benign view of Australia as a land of clear skies and a wholesome produce and very good universities. All of that, I think, is collected by this, the first survey of its kind.
Can I talk to you about the universities? Because education is one of Australia's leading export products. I think it's third or fourth in our export list. And yet it's a bit disappointing, isn't it, the response here to education overall? Because according to your survey, the business people overwhelmingly backed the US, 53% favouring it for education of their children, compared with 36% for Britain and only 9% for Australia.
But when they take into account other factors, best lifestyle for students, Australia's got 45%, the US 31%, the UK only 16%, most reasonable cost of living for students, Australia comes out at 58%, the US at 21%, things seem to balance out. Safest and most secure from crime and violence, Australia streets are headed, 55%, the US 15%, UK 19%. These are factors that weigh. I think America, with its world-class, with its front-rank universities, is always going to be realistically impossible to beat when it comes to what university system will best prepare you for the work of the 21st century. That was the hardest question asked. But those other considerations seem to tilt the overall balance very favourably towards a choice in Australia.
I think it's true to say that this survey was conducted before the crackdown on Chinese property investment, just a month or so ago, and also, I think, before the submarine decision. I'm not sure about that. Australia's potential purchase, there's no decision yet, but strong hints that Australia is looking to Japan. Would those elements change these results, do you think?
I'm not sure the tier of business leadership involved in this survey would worry much about access to expensive property purchases in Australian cities. I don't think they're in the band that would be weighing that as an option for their investment. I think the biggest challenge we've got in managing this relationship is the appearance that if we go for the Japanese submarines without a rigorous assessment, call it what you will, of the European alternatives, it emerges as something of a strategic statement rather than Australia deciding to get its submarines from the nation offering the best deal. Mm-hmm. And I think we've got to be careful of giving the impression, I don't think it's remotely in Australia's interest to give the impression, that we're drifting into a trilateral understanding with the US and Japan, Australia, the US and Japan, that would have us take the side of Japan in the event of a clash between it and China over the maritime territorial dispute in the East China Sea, in which it is in our interest to be rigorously neutral.
Okay, you're listening to RN Breakfast. It's 13 past 8. Our guest is former Foreign Minister of Australia, Bob Carr, currently the Director of the UTS Australia-China Relations Institute. Bob Carr, of course, also a former long-serving Labor Premier of New South Wales. Bob Carr, on that front, the New South Wales state election is in 6 days' time. Labor is running strongly against the central Mike Baird policy of privatisation of the electricity poles and wires. And you are quoted in a Liberal Party television ad where you say, quote, Labor should pass the coalition's partial privatisation. Have the Liberals misrepresented you? Is that your firm and long-held view?
Yeah, they've got no basis for that quote, no basis whatsoever. And that was explained to the Telegraph, which is taking a very vigorous approach in this election campaign. But I'd say this, there's a big difference between privatising poles and wires to get for the taxpayer an estimated $30 billion and selling assets that earn you $1.7 billion a year and getting only, I think this is the agreed figure, $11 billion. The economics of this have been recast by what has happened in this market over the 15 to 20 years that have
So once it was a good idea, but you're saying...
Premier.
So well, once I, it was a good idea and you and your treasurer thought it was a good idea, but now you're saying it's not a good idea.
Well, let the taxpayers make this judgment next Saturday, Fran. The difference between securing $30 billion for assets or selling them for $11 billion and forgoing the revenue, which is, according to the estimate I've seen, $1.7 billion a year. A huge difference.
So you're on board with Luke Foley's campaign against this policy?
I strongly support the election of a Labor government, and I believe that Labor under Luke Foley's leadership will do strikingly well. Whether that gets it to the point of a hung parliament, let alone a Labor government, is going to be determined by the events of the last days of this campaign.
Do you think it could be that close?
Well, looking at when voters go into vote on Saturday, they'll be thinking of two things. They'll be thinking of electricity privatisation on the basis of the deal before the government, that is, losing forgoing revenue of $1.7 billion a year to gain a one-off boost, a sugar hit to the budget of $11 billion. And they'll be thinking of Tony Abbott's leadership. They're the factors that are going to be weighing heavily on voters next Saturday. And I should think both considerations would give Labor a lot of optimism in the fight of the last few days.
It's 16 past 8. Just finally, Bob Carr, you were Foreign Minister of Australia when Labor reopened the Nauru Detention Centre. We've now received the Moss Review, the inquiry into allegations of abuse on Nauru. We've been discussing it this morning. We spoke earlier with Julie Bishop and others. The Moss report found horrible allegations of rape and assault at the centre. Do you share any sense of shame about that, or your concern about the reopening of that centre? Does it cause you to rethink or give pause?
Fran, I strongly support the principle of offshore processing and offshore assessment.
If we can't keep people safe, women and children safe?
Yeah, but I don't accept the logic of that. I accept the compelling argument for stopping the boats by saying to people, smugglers, there'll be no one assessed on Australian soil. It'll be an offshore assessment and offshore resettlement. But surely it is not beyond the wit of a wealthy country like Australia, with good governance, as Australia has, to get it right and to see that there is appropriate protection enforced for the
people
who are being
processed. If we can't, should we shut them down?
Well, I believe we can do it, and I believe on balance all the arguments that the Labor cabinet settled on for offshore processing and offshore settlement remain valid today. It was the only way of stopping that growth month on month of the people being brought to Australian territory by people smugglers. It was the only way to bring that to a halt. Indeed, I think Labor can accept the Labor's entitled to demand the credit for the ceasing in people smuggling activity that has occurred in the last year.
Bob
but
Carr,
it,
thank
it can
you very
be
much.
Done humanely and decently.
Bob Carr, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Fran.
Bob Carr, Australia's former Foreign Minister and Director of the Australia-China Relations Institute at the University of Technology, Sydney.